Republicans to wake up. The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to.
Do it live!
Now, from the Left Coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Thank you for downloading the latest episode of the Peter B. Collins Show. I want to thank the people who support this program, like John DeVries, Andrew Krieger, David Mills, and Bill Lackamacher. They are voluntary subscribers, and you can do it too. Just visit my website at peterbcollins.com. On the right-hand side of the homepage are the links to PayPal, where you can subscribe for as little as $5 a month.
In a land that's known as freedom, how can such a thing be fair?
Our intro music today from Graham Nash and David Crosby. They reunited with Stephen Stills this past weekend here in the Bay Area for a No Nukes reunion concert. It was Crosby, Stills, and Nash, Bonnie Raitt, Jackson Browne, and Tom Morello, former frontman for Rage Against the Machine, really ruled. And we're going to talk about that concert and the issues that it addresses, trying to end nuclear power plants in this country. Harvey Wasserman will join us in the second segment today.
Won't you please come to Chicago for a ride?
But first, Henry Knorr has returned. We last spoke to him just before he was about to embark to the Mediterranean, hoping to join the Gaza Freedom Flotilla, and the efforts were thwarted this year. Henry, thanks for joining us to update us on your adventures.
Thanks for inviting me. I'm happy to be here.
So we last spoke to you about a week before you left the United States, and why don't you give us a quick sketch of your travels and what you found when you arrived in Greece?
Well, I left the Bay Area on June 18th. I went to New York. We had some meetings of the crew, beginning to do a little, at least getting to know each other and some training. We had a very crowded press conference at the United Nations, and then we headed off to Athens and started doing training, getting ready for our nonviolence training in preparation for the trip.
And that's an important point, because last year, in the events that garnered a great deal of publicity, where nine people, including a young man holding dual American citizenship, was killed on the Mavi Marmara, there were concerns that some of the people on the flotilla didn't honor the nonviolent code.
Yes. We were completely sworn to nonviolence. We, of course, had no weapons. We had a lot of nonviolence training. The group included a lot of people with a lot of experience in nonviolent direct action. Kitty mm-hmm. Kelly from the Center for Creative Nonviolence, and Medea Benjamin from Code Pink, and Alice Walker, the novelist, and so on. But we were there was no question we were going to be nonviolent all along. And obviously the Israelis knew that. Just one correction on what you said. Mm-hmm. The young man who had American citizenship, who was killed on the Mavi Marmara, although it was, as you said, originally reported that he was a dual citizen, it turns out that, in fact, he was only an American citizen.
Oh, good.
He didn't actually have Turkish citizenship.
So, all right. I'm happy to be corrected. Thanks.
It was widely reported that way, and mm-hmm. only very recently as attorneys established that he was solely an American citizen. And mm-hmm. It's actually a minor detail, but it's pretty shocking that the U.S. government and the U.S. media did practically nothing about his murder, really. And the autopsy showed that he was shot 4 or 5 times at point-blank range.
And he was armed with a video camera.
Armed with the video camera, yes.
Right, yeah. So the nonviolent training, and did you have what you believe to be strong consensus in the flotilla contingents?
Oh, absolutely. You know, the whole thing about, you know, nobody had any, you'd have to be really crazy to think you're going to confront the Israeli military, you know, on these smallish boats. You know, that's one of the, supposedly the fourth most powerful military in the world. And a bunch of activists in rickety old boats. You know, there was never any intention, and the Israelis obviously knew that.
Well, and we need to underscore that in the events of 2010 on Memorial Day U.S. Observance, the flotilla was attacked by Israeli forces in international waters. And they invaded these unarmed ships like pirates.
Yes.
And so any kind of a reaction in self-defense, for me, is understandable, even if it crossed the line, regrettably, into, you know, noncompliance with the Pledge of Nonviolence.
Right. You know, I don't know what kind of understanding the Turkish people on the Mavi Marmara had or what kind of training they had. I can really only speak for the U.S. boat to Gaza. But I will say that the the video that everybody probably has seen from the 2010 flotilla of the attack or parts of the attack where the some people aboard the Mavi Marmara were fighting with clubs and sticks and poles of various sorts.
And they heaved a soldier overboard.
Down a deck, actually, yeah. Not into the sea. But but all that was very carefully edited, and the Israelis have to this day refused to make available the numerous other videos that were taken by various people. What they did was they hastily edited up something that showed their version of the events, which seemed to indicate that the Turks started the violence, the fighting. There are countless eyewitnesses, people who are on the boat, who say that, in fact, the Israelis began firing from the helicopters before those scenes, and that people were only trying to defend themselves as these heavily armed IDF commandos were rappelling down the ropes on board the ship and that there's strong evidence that at least two people had been shot and killed before anybody, any of the Israelis had set foot and before any of that fighting began. But I don't really want to, I wasn't there, and I don't want to talk too much about that event,
sure.
Just to say that there's an awful lot of media manipulation that goes on about these things.
Indeed. Now, Henry, tell us where the different boats were moored, because there were several ports, right, in Greece that the flotilla was organizing in and getting ready to leave from?
Yes, the boats were scattered, and they were supposed to be, well, at various times leading up to it, there were a large number of boats who were hoping to participate. By the time the final plan, there were going to be 10. That was after the Turkish boats, including the Mavi Marmara, pulled out. There are various explanations for why they pulled out, but it's pretty clear that what really happened was that the Turkish government kind of leaned on the organizers, the IHH, the NGO, the nonprofit organization that was organizing it. Their government leaned on them to back off and stay out of it this year under pressure from the Israelis and the U.S. That left 10 boats. One was in I believe only one was in a Turkish port. One or two left from France, and the rest were in Greek ports, some around Athens, around Piraeus, the main port of Athens, including the U.S. boat, which we would call the Audacity of Hope.
Mm-hmm.
We were originally in a small place called Parama, which is right next door. It's really functionally part of the large, well-known port of Piraeus, but it's the next town over. And other boats that were planned to be in the flotilla were in various ports by design and by just the practicalities, because the different organizing groups from various countries made their own arrangements. But also we didn't want to have them all concentrated in one place. It would have made it too easy.
To corral or sabotage.
Corral, yeah, right.
Mm-hmm.
We had only been in Athens a few days. Actually, our plan, this isn't well known, but the plan was actually for the boat to leave Parama next to Athens And sailed to Crete without the passengers. And then the passengers, were going to take a commercial ferry to Crete and then mm-hmm. board the Audacity of Hope there.
Mm-hmm.
And the boat had been inspected by the Greek maritime authorities earlier, and there were no problems. It was we had all the paperwork. It was registered in Delaware. Technically speaking, the owner was a Greek attorney, and he had submitted all the paperwork and so on. But when they put in the forms to say they were going to sail the boat to Crete, permission was denied. And that was the first sign, although we had had some suspicions, that was the first sign that the Greeks were going to, obstruct the process. There was debate at the beginning about whether they were really determined to prevent it or whether they were just kind of hassling us to show the Israelis that they were being careful.
Mm-hmm. And we have to put into context here that Greece is on its knees as a nation.
Absolutely.
That it is financially, it has been run up against the wall by the banks, and they're now in the disaster capitalism mode, where they keep extracting more cutbacks and concessions in exchange for bailout funds, and the Prime Minister Papandreou has no real leverage. And I don't know if there were any financial levers used on Greece to get it to prevent you from leaving, but I would suspect there were.
I'm sure there were. Of all the times and places, this is really coincidental, but of all the times and places to try to do something that that the U.S. and Israel were determined to prevent, that we really happened on a very bad time, because, yeah, as you said, Greece was, really under the thumb of the international, the banks, the European Central Bank, the Germans, the French, the Americans, all together, and really didn't have any capacity, I think, to resist. Historically, Greeks has had very kind of pro-Palestinian positions within the limits of being a member of NATO and the European Union and so on. Greece, way back in 1947, voted against the original UN resolution that partitioned Palestine and laid the foundation for the State of Israel. And they have traditionally had a kind of pro-Palestinian, certainly among the Greek public, there's very strong support for the Palestinians. And the government has, somewhat respected that. But in this case, clearly the government didn't have any capacity to take an independent position. I thought the main factor was the financial issues. It turns out to be a little bit more complicated as we've researched more. The Israelis have actually been cultivating the Greeks ever since, even before the last year's flotilla, as Turkey began to adopt a more independent and critical position in relation to Israel. The Israelis tried to balance that by improving their relations with the Greeks going back several years. And then after the flotilla and the Mavi Marmara incident, kind of break with of diplomatic ties with Turkey and military cooperation between Israel and Turkey being suspended, the Israelis moved very aggressively, I'm sure with a combination of carrots and sticks, to create a tighter relationship with Greece. Papandreou visited Israel. Netanyahu came back and went on a cruise to the Greek islands with Papandreou, and apparently they each brought their families at one for part of the trip and so on. There's also, they set up some joint military exercises for the first time, because in the Israelis used to do a lot of air exercises over in Turkish airspace, and the Turks, after the Mavi Marmara, the Turks cut that off, so they switched over and arranged with the Greeks. There was a plan to sell arms to Greece. Israel is a very large exporter of military equipment now.
Mm-hmm.
So there were deep ties that we ran into, yes.
If you'll forgive me,
sure.
Enough about the Greeks.
Okay.
What about the United States of America? And in particular, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. Now, this occurred just weeks after Netanyahu barnstormed into Washington with the support of AIPAC and even many Democratic senators. We saw Senator Reid, the majority leader, part with the president and side with the prime minister of Israel over discussions. Okay, these are not, you know, hardened policies. These were proposals that Obama had made. And the way that the AIPAC-dominated members of Congress rallied around Netanyahu at the expense of Obama set, I think, an important tone. And so going forward, as you were organizing, we got clear messages from Secretary of State Clinton that you were regarded as renegades and that any kind of military action used against you would be deserved, justified, and the U.S. wouldn't lift a finger to protect you. Now, that's my interpretation. Those are not quotes. What's yours?
Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, as she said in this context, that Israel has the right to defend itself as if we were somehow a threat to Israel. We actually had a meeting at the embassy, not with the political staff. They wouldn't meet with us, but with the consular people. And they were saying some similar things. We pointed out that we actually had no plan, no intention, no desire to go to Israel. We were going to sail from Greek waters into international waters and to Gaza's territorial waters. Israel should have had nothing to do with it. But Hillary Clinton kept, and the rest of them kept talking about Israel's laws and Israel's policies and so on, as if Gaza were in fact part of Israel, which it is not. But clearly, clearly the Americans were behind, you know, the exact balance of who had the most influence on the Greeks or put the most pressure, whether it was the Americans or the Israelis, we don't know. But functionally, it doesn't matter because they were all on the same side. But I will say, I do want to point out that, you know, even though the flotilla was stymied and our original intention we were not able to carry out, the Hillary Clinton statement, I think, points to what was successful about it. Actually, for 3 days running that week, the United States, the State Department put out official statements about the flotilla. And if you look at the transcripts of the press briefings they held those days, it was a major subject of conversation. And the reporters even began to grill them about, are you saying that the blockade of Gaza is legal? Which the United States has never officially said, and they had went back and forth about that. Some of the reporters also confronted them with the contradiction that same week Hillary Clinton had endorsed the action of the women in Saudi Arabia who tried to drive their cars, another illegal action under Saudi law. And the reporters wanted to know why a provocative violation of the law in that case was a good thing, according to because Hillary endorsed it. But in our case, it was a terrible evil. But the main thing, you know, where we succeeded, I think that we never actually expected to get to Gaza in view of what happened a year ago.
Well, I did.
you know, I think, you know, up to there were some early votes from the Free Gaza Movement that did get through, five of them starting in 2008. But after beginning in 2009, they blocked all the subsequent votes. They blocked the flotilla. They made all kinds of noises in the aftermath of the flotilla attack that they were never going to allow this to happen again. So I didn't actually have the expectation that we would get to Gaza. I was pretty sure we would get stopped. In fact, we got stopped much earlier and in a different way because they, in effect, outsourced the blockade to the Greeks. But really, the whole thing was a political demonstration. It was designed to make a point to call attention, call the world attention to the conditions in Gaza, which remains, in effect, an outdoor prison. The people are still subject to collective punishment, still denied they have 45% unemployment, 85 or 90%, according to various estimates, of their water is contaminated because they can't get, Israelis won't allow the purification equipment in. They have no economy. The Israelis won't. They have loosened up in the aftermath of the flotilla a year ago. They let in somewhat more food for the few people who can afford it. Most people are dependent on these big sacks of rice and stuff delivered by the United Nations. So they're not starving, as the Israelis are fond of pointing out, but they're totally dependent, confined. And one of the interesting things that most people don't know is a major aspect of the siege of Gaza is they're not allowed to export anything. Their main exports are cut flowers and fresh fruit, strawberries and other fruit, and some amount of cheap furniture for things like college dormitories and things like that. Now, what security, the Israelis claim this is all about security. What is the security justification for not allowing people to export strawberries and cut flowers from Gaza? Anyway.
Those are dual-use items.
Right. You can throw them. But we did succeed in the sense that the thing was always going to be, really the real goal was to make a, to stage a demonstration, make a point, try to get some media attention. We did get an enormous amount of media attention. We had, you know, and really it's because of the blood of the Turks. I obviously the media was thinking that, gee, maybe more people will get killed and we can get the video. So we had reporters from all kinds of outlets, mainstream, as well as things like Democracy Now, competing for a place on our boats. If we had sailed, we were going to have two people from CNN and AP, CBS, Democracy Now, so on. They all wanted to be on board, and in fact, we all ended up in this limbo where we spent about 10 days in Athens, not entirely sure what was going to happen. So we had a chance to spend a lot of time with the media people, and I think we had a real effect on them. We got amazingly positive coverage from many outlets that you wouldn't expect. NPR, which usually doesn't treat activists very respectfully, did a perfectly fine story about us. Even the New York Times gave us some quite decent coverage. And when our captain was arrested, they did a follow-up story specifically about that.
I saw that.
So
I will say I agree with you that you generated a lot of publicity and most of it was positive. But in the corporate media in this country, the Israeli spin continues to dominate. And the subtext was clearly delivered that the media accepts the Israeli representation, that they have relaxed the restrictions on goods moving in and out of Gaza. As you point out, it's mostly in, not out. And also in reference to the Rafah border crossing with Egypt, during the month of May and June, it appeared that that was going to be blown open. And it was briefly opened, and I believe the current status is really back to where it was before the Tahrir Square Revolution, right?
Roughly speaking, they let a few people through. It's a little bit ambiguous, but it turns out it's very, very limited. And that crossing, by the way, is only for people. It's only
goods go through the tunnels.
The goods go through the tunnels to the extent that they can. Yes, but the Rafah thing, it was never going to solve the problem of, for instance, the most acute need aside from water and sewage treatment equipment. The most acute need is for cement and steel for rebuilding from the damage that the Israelis did in 2008 and 2009, the so-called Operation Cast Lead. But on your point about the media, obviously. No single action is going to overcome the grip of the so-called Israeli narrative, the Israeli spin on in our media and our political system. All we can do is chip away at it, and I think we did, you know, knock a few chips out of it by making a few more people, stop and take a look at the realities. For instance, I believe the last count I saw just the passengers on the boat, I believe. Generated 28 op-eds in their local newspapers around the country, some in fairly significant, the LA Times, the Oakland Tribune, the Bay Area News Group papers, and other papers in the East Coast. Obviously, we didn't make the big ones like the New York Times and so on, but we did make, you know, second and third tier papers, and, you know, even a good op-ed doesn't balance the overall dominance of the Israeli version of reality. But it, you know, I have to believe that it just is, you know, like this program, every bit of information of truth we can get out to counter the lies and distortions has to help. I think, you know, if anything's going to change U.S. policy and Israeli policy, I do believe it's ultimately going to be economic pressure. Rather, you know, I don't think that demonstrations like this or even that fly-in that followed the flotilla or even the marches of the Palestinians by themselves are probably not going to change things. It's going to take outside economic pressure. Mm-hmm. But things that call attention to the issue, that make people, at least if some people, open their eyes and and try to look beyond to start to question whether they're getting the whole story from the mainstream media. That can feed on the process that ultimately has to bring change over there.
Mm-hmm. Henry, give us a quick sketch of the episode involving the captain of the Audacity of Hope, because from what I could glean, there were a couple of issues. One was that they created a paperwork issue, and that they said the proper permits and I guess inspections hadn't been conducted. And then, as I understood it, at one point, your captain just tossed off the lines, left the dock, and started to steam away. I guess the equivalent of the Coast Guard in Greece intercepted and forced you to return to port. So give us a little more about
that.
Yeah,
you've got the basic outlines, right? I will say this paperwork problem was a funny kind of paperwork because there was no paper. They would never actually give us a list of the ways they thought our boat was not meeting the maritime standards. And everybody involved, the inspectors, the port people, everybody, you know, acknowledged between the lines that this was a... They were doing this under orders from their government, that these were not...
Did you fail to grease the inspectors?
Well, that may have been a part of it, but I think we didn't have enough grease, no matter what we might have done. But
well, you were in grease. Come on.
But, you know, they were very clear. I mean, I don't know if any of your listeners have been to Piraeus, but it's a huge maritime complex with, you know, hundreds of boats coming in and out all day. And everybody said they'd never seen anything like this, you know, with this. I mean, some of the issues, as I said, they never put the complaints on paper, but verbally, at one point they said we didn't have enough life preservers, even though we had actually the organizers had bought a brand new state of the art 2011 model life preservers, you know, the very best that money can buy, stacked up all over the boat. They complained because in the sheafs of paperwork we'd given them about the boat, one of the forms describing the boat said it had a fiberglass hull. All the others said it had a steel hull. In fact, it had a steel hull. All you had to do was look at it,
sure,
tap on it, and you could see it was a steel hull.
A magnet
might
work.
They made a big deal. Somebody somewhere along the line on one piece of paper had in the past had made a mistake and said it was fiberglass. So who knows how that happened. But in any case, it didn't make any difference because the reality was obvious that it was a steel-hulled boat, and that's what all the other papers said. But they made a big deal out of this so-called discrepancy. You know, these things, first they denied us the permission to go to Crete, and then they kept bringing up more and more bogus issues and being very vague about what had to be done to resolve them or when that could be done. And and as all the other boats began to encounter similar problems, and two of the boats were actually physically sabotaged in a very dangerous way, so it began to be clear to us that, you know, that they weren't just going through some kind of motions, but they were really trying to obstruct us. And the captain of our boat, who's named John Klusmeyer, he's a captain of whale watching and other things in the Monterey Bay area. He'd been in Athens for about 4 weeks supervising the preparations of the boat, the Audacity of Hope. He was very frustrated. He knew that the boat was shipshape. It's actually a very nice boat. He was at least as frustrated as any of the rest of us. But as it became clear that they were just putting up more and more obstacles, we wanted to break out. At least, I mean, we didn't really think we would be able to get past the Greek authorities if they were determined to stop us. But we wanted to call their bluff. We wanted to try to make clear that the issue wasn't the seaworthiness of the boat or any of these other vague objections they had made, but really a policy decision on their part. We hesitated for a while. The organizing committee for the Greek boat they actually have ties in the Papandreou government. They have connections. They kept saying for a while that they could work something out, just hold on, don't do anything drastic. But as the days went by, it became clear that we had to that wasn't going to work. They could wait because they were home. We didn't have the money and the time to stay there indefinitely. And they finally agreed. We were actually planning to leave. So we finally decided, okay, we would just up anchor and take off and see how far we got. But then the captain hesitated a little bit because he had a lot on the line more than any of the rest of us, because he's a professional. He's legally responsible for the boat, and as a licensed captain could be subject to professional discipline. So the first day we planned to go, he decided, no, he didn't want to do it. He wasn't ready. Then he had another discussion with the Greek authorities, and he was so fed up, he said, all right, let's do it. So we actually called the press together without telling them. We had a press conference on the dock. I spent a lot of time sweeping the dock to make it nice for the reporters.
we should point out here that you spent 20 years as a journalist yourself.
Yes.
And so to be cleaning up for others.
we briefed them about the state of things and a little bit of speechifying and so on. The people who were in our already on the boat hopped on the boat, and we pulled up the gangway, and off we went.
And this is in broad daylight.
In broad daylight.
You didn't sneak away.
4:30 in the afternoon. Yeah. No. Mm-hmm. We had all the media all around us. I have to assume that the Greeks and the Israelis knew everything that we were planning anyway. But it was glorious because it was, it's very hot in Athens, and we'd been trapped in this hot city, and there was strikes and tear gas all over the place. We finally got out on the open sea, and it was felt great. Everybody was exhilarated. But that lasted for about 25 minutes, and then the Coast Guard boat came, a small cutter and a Zodiac, an inflatable Coast Guard boat, came along and approached us and ordered the captain to stop and moved in front of the boat so we couldn't proceed. We didn't intend to defy them, if they issued an order. But the captain tried to negotiate to explain to them that their objections about our paperwork were bogus. And it was funny because there's a special channel on the maritime radio for these kind of official communications, but it didn't work. So what happened was that the captains ended up
breaker
yelling,
19, yeah, breaker, breaker.
They ended up yelling out their windows or portholes or whatever to back and forth to each other for, a good half hour or longer. And with the Greek guy actually pleading with us to go back, he said, you can go tomorrow, which we knew that was ridiculous. And we kept stalling, and the captain, people started singing songs to the Greeks and so on. And then what happened was they brought up another boat with heavily armed commandos, all dressed head to toe in black with some kind of big guns and flak jackets and so on. All the guns pointed right at us and ordered us to get moving and stop stalling. And at that point, the captain, we had all agreed the captain would make the decisions in this kind of a situation, and he's in charge, and he decided at that time, enough defiance, it was time to turn around. They took us back, escorted us back into the harbor, and put us in a... At a Greek military Coast Guard pier, or I don't know if it was Coast Guard or military, but it was surrounded by fencing and barbed wire and so on. Apparently it's a pier that the American embassy uses regularly for various purposes, among other things. But on the compound, there was a lot where cars that had been wrecked by American diplomats in traffic accidents were stored. And the taxi drivers... it was kind of far even from the bus, so we had to use taxis. First they wouldn't let us out. They kept us in this fenced-in compound. Eventually they agreed we could come and go as long as we presented our passports and checked in with them and so on. So we ended up taking some cabs, and the cab drivers all said, oh, that's the American pier. So clearly there was something going on there. Mm-hmm. And they kept the boat there for... actually, for many weeks. As far as I know, it's still there. We wanted to move it, at least if we couldn't get out to sea, we wanted to move it to a private pier, and they wouldn't let us move anywhere. We did during the time.
So it's essentially impounded.
Yeah, the legal status of it is somewhat unclear. I mean, I think basically the Greeks were making their rules up on the fly. In fact, the very afternoon we were at 4:30 in the afternoon on the day we were leaving, just minutes before we left, the Minister of Civil Protection, who's in charge of the Coast Guard there, issued a decree that no boats could sail from any Greek port to Gaza. So we did succeed in kind of forcing them to up the ante and acknowledge that this was a government policy and mm-hmm. not just some technical deficiency of our paperwork or our boat. And they kept the boat afterwards for, you know, they wouldn't let us move it even. The legal basis, the lawyers, Greek lawyers, I talked a little bit to a Greek lawyer. He said there was no legal basis for any of this decree about not sailing to Gaza. There's no mm-hmm. legal basis for that and holding the boat and so on. The conditions were difficult because the whole thing was, actually more grueling than you might have expected because in some sense nothing happened. But in hot weather, we didn't have a lot of, we packed very lightly. I was just living out of a small backpack. And most of us hadn't brought a lot of money because we didn't want to have it stolen by the Israelis who we thought would be stopping us. In the last year, they mm-hmm. stole the money of the people they detained. So we didn't want that to happen. So the whole thing, it was pretty grueling. But after a while, they did improve things a little bit. Oh, I want to say about the captain. They did arrest the captain. They kept him in jail for 4 days. Originally, he was jailed by the harbor master in a relatively decent jail with air conditioning and so on. And the Greek government ordered him moved to the local police lockup, which seemed just petty harassment to a cell where there was no air conditioning, no bathroom facilities, and so on. We were quite annoyed about that. But we did. We had a demonstration. We mounted a demonstration at the court. After 4 days, they held a hearing, and we were doing a lot of demonstrations all around town, and actually in coordination with their equivalent of Tahrir Square. There's the square in downtown Athens, where there was this tent encampment and hundreds, sometimes thousands of people there. And they joined us, and we demonstrated at the courthouse. We got a lot of media attention. It was front page news in Greece for days. And they did finally, at that point, let the captain out with no bail and no travel restrictions. Technically speaking, the charges were not dropped, but they referred them to some panel to review them. And last I heard, the Greek lawyers thought that was the charges would probably go away. But mm-hmm. at least the captain got out.
Henry, I want to ask you a little bit about the inner workings of the activist groups. And the first question that comes to mind is, we've seen a pattern of FBI informants being ordered to infiltrate peace groups. And we saw last September a coordinated raid on peaceniks in Chicago, Milwaukee, and other cities. And so I'm just curious, did you have any process to try to weed out a potential infiltrator? And did you have any suspicions that you had been infiltrated and that there was some sort of a provocateur in your midst?
I will say that we were very aware of that issue, and in fact, Palestine Solidarity activists have been really the principal target, among others, but the principal target of those recent FBI moves against activists. So we were very wary of that. I don't have any indication. I don't say it's impossible, but I don't have any evidence that we were infiltrated. We did a very thorough process of selection before the group was put together, or as the group was put together, through a very thorough process. It was a little bit like applying to college. You had to submit an application and write essays about various aspects of your experience and submit the names of references, which I know for a fact were checked. Not to say that that somebody couldn't have faked their way through that, but it was way more thorough than any other political action or any political action that I've ever been involved with before. Mm-hmm. So we did make efforts. Anything happened And most of that was very early because, actually, I believe the deadline for the applications was in January, if I remember correctly. Because originally, at one point, we thought we were going to sail in March. And at that point, it was kind of under the radar in terms of the mass media, the mainstream media. As it began to get more publicity, we got all kinds of phone calls from people we'd never heard of before, desperate to get on the boat.
Mm-hmm.
people who claimed, though, they were longtime activists, but nobody had ever heard of them. Mm-hmm. And so I suspect many of those people were, probably agents of one sort or another trying to get on, but they didn't, obviously.
The other I'm curious about is just how it's all organized and if there's a hierarchy, because from my perspective, Colonel Anne Wright seemed to be a main driver of this effort. But she's a remarkable woman who I don't think particularly seeks to be in charge of everything. And so I'm just curious how it was organized, and as you were dealing with these circumstances that were quite unpredictable, who would be making the final decisions? Was it a committee, a consensus, or was there a single person who was designated?
Well, and Colonel Anne Wright, for people who don't know, is indeed, as you say, a remarkable woman. She's a former many decades in the U.S. military, eventually became a diplomat working for the State Department, and then resigned in 2001.
One.
One,
or
thank
two.
You.
Early 2002.
In protest of policy in Afghanistan and Iraq. And has since then become a very dedicated and activist and a real...
Array of fronts.
On many fronts, yes.
She works on every important issue.
Absolutely. And she really is terrific. She's very articulate and personable and full of energy and clear about what she's doing. I was very impressed. She was in charge. She was the... there was an organizing committee that put this project together. They recruited her, but... the organizing committee, made the decisions in the early stages about finding the boat and buying, leasing it, whatever. But she was in charge of the group on the ground in Greece, and that was all something we all acknowledged. But she's a, it was not like a military hierarchy or something. There was mm-hmm. a lot of consultation and meetings, and we talked through the issues. Up above her level, there was the original organizing group had a number of people in Athens who were not planning to go on the boat, who were on the what they call the land crew, and they were represented on there was an international coalition, a flotilla coalition that met with representatives from 22 countries who were represented on the various boats. I didn't go to that. I wasn't at that level at all, so I can't speak from personal experience, but that was the overall decision-making body for the flotilla. But each of the national groups or the some of the boats were multinational. There was a Greek-Swedish boat, for instance, several countries that couldn't afford their own boat. They combined to make a boat. So they had a more complicated decision-making process, I suppose. Mm-hmm. But each group had its own autonomy. There were some frictions and so on. It was definitely a frustrating experience. There was a time... There were a few days when apparently, at least what we heard, was that we were ready to do this trick of trying to sail and disregard the lack of the refusal of the authorities to give us permission. The International Flotilla Committee, in particular the Greeks, who played a large role in that because it was on their turf, they were very hesitant about that because they kept thinking maybe they could work out something with the Greek government. So there was tension and conflict, sure. As there isn't any kind of decision-making process. But
so, Henry, what would you like to add here that we haven't covered so far about your experience with the flotilla that didn't get to sail?
Well, I think, the most important thing is, if people have some interest in this, to think about the Palestinians, because that's really what this was all about. It's really not about us or the Greeks or... whatever. The real issue is that there are 1.5 million or 1.6 million people who are penned in to this place where they are not, they are not free to come and go. They can't leave to get education or medical care. There are a few exceptions, but on the whole, they can't travel. They have virtually no economy, 45% unemployed, 80-plus percent dependent on the United Nations for food. Obama himself a year ago said, after the first flotilla, said this is, situation is unsustainable. That's one thing where I absolutely agree with him. It is unsustainable. It's illegal. It's immoral. It's unjust. It's inhumane. And it goes on year after year after year. And, you know, when I went to Gaza the first time, the only time I've been there in 2002, the main thing I heard from the people there who were very warm and welcoming, delighted to have someone from the outside visiting them, and the main thing they said was, tell the world, how can this be going on? How can you, your government and the UN and all the European countries that profess to believe in democracy and human rights and so on, how can they allow this to go on? Why does Israel get an exemption from the rules that are applied to every other country in the world? They're not applied consistently to, as we know, there are many other abuses. But Israel is the only country that gets all the, on our dollar, our nickel, you know, with $3 billion a year plus, and that's only the official accounting. Mm-hmm. The reality is even larger. U.S. money to carry out these policies that are in open defiance of international law, open defiance of multiple Security Council resolutions, even in defiance of stated American, nominal American policy. So the main message I would want to leave to people is, let's not get distracted in the arguments about whether the flow, who was armed or not armed, because that's obviously bogus, or whether the boat was seaworthy, all kinds of bogus arguments here. The real problem is that we are struggling in our small way, us, the activists, to try to call attention to the world to this really dire situation, that 1.5 million people confined for decades in these terrible conditions.
Well, Henry Knorr, thanks for this update. Thank you for putting your life on the line to attempt to make this important statement. And you represented me in this, and I just want to thank you.
Well, thanks very much. That's very, very moving.
Henry Knorr here on the Peter B. Collins Show. Joining us now on the Peter B. Collins Show, Mr. No Nukes Hisself. Harvey Wasserman has temporarily escaped from Columbus, Ohio, and is here on the left coast. Jackson Browne joined many other great musicians this past Sunday for a benefit concert for Muse, Musicians United for Safe Energy.
Give us 20 minutes and we'll give you the world. We bring good things to life.
And it was a concert free of corporate messages, but there are a lot of interesting messages about nuclear power, about the risk that it poses to us, both from the generations of plants now in service and the future plans that have been embraced by the Obama administration to build more nuclear power plants in this country. Harvey Wasserman, welcome back to our program.
Peter, it's really great to be with you, man.
Well,
terrific.
First, I have to say what a great concert it was, and it was really great to be with like-minded people, and it lifted our spirits musically, but also I think you helped educate and activate a lot of people about the issues at hand. Let's talk about the music, first of all. You got kissed on the lips by Bonnie, by Bonnie Raitt?
Well, I don't know about the lips, but Bonnie and I are old buddies. She's the most beautiful woman on earth,
isn't she?
She is just magnificent.
Yeah,
and I had the opportunity to die for. I mean, I don't want to like sound like, hey, I'm so cool, but to stand backstage and listen to "Angel from Montgomery," which to me is the most beautiful song ever written, mm-hmm. as sung by Bonnie. Although I have heard it sung by John Prine. It wasn't bad by John Prine, but
Bonnie. There was a Chicago folkie named Bonnie Kolak, who I worked in Chicago in the 70s, and she had a local hit with Angel from Montgomery at that time.
Really, really?
Yeah.
Well, mm-hmm. Nobody does it better than Bonnie, including the guy who wrote it. I mean, she just really, it's her song,
yeah.
And it always moves me. And then I was called out to sing, and she gave me a big hug, and I said, well, it's all downhill from here. So, you know, and then I got to rant at 11,000 people. Mm-hmm. I don't even know what I said.
Frankly. You were coherent.
I can tell you.
Oh, I was out there in the crowd, and you made sense.
And then they made the mistake of allowing me to go back a second time, and I told everybody to kick butt.
Yeah.
And then I had the fun of telling everybody, which I have five daughters, and the youngest are 19 and 12.
Mm-hmm.
And they called me because they were listening on the internet.
Yeah.
And that was such a great thing. Hey, you know, my girls heard me on to tell 11,000 people in California.
I heard the shout out.
Yeah. So that was fun.
Yeah.
I had walked, whenever I speak, I always walk the crowd beforehand if I can. And this was a very family, you know, beautiful crowd, wonderful people, very warm and friendly. And I figured 90% of them had kids and would get a kick out of hearing about mine back in Ohio listening to the show. So, but the music was spectacular. Bonnie Jackson,
Crosby, Stills, and Nash,
the Doobie Brothers, Tom Morello.
Hey, let's pause for Tom Morello for a moment.
Mm.
He really cut through and connected with the crowd. He did This Land Is Your Land.
Oh, yeah, totally.
With the expurgated verses added back in.
Mm-hmm.
It was really touching. And then he went into the Ghost of Tom Joad, the Springsteen song.
Right.
And was playing his guitar with every available tool.
With his teeth.
Including his teeth.
Right. And, which I can't do anymore.
And was just projecting incredibly.
Yeah, it was a wonderful, wonderful event. I hope people will be able to plug into it. There will be various YouTubes coming out. And, you know, there's a Musicians United 4 with the number 4 Safe Energy website. There's nukefree.org website.
Mm-hmm.
And so we are continuing this fight. This was about shutting down the nuclear power industry in the wake of Fukushima. And so we did have a woman from Japan who spoke, Eileen Smith, and she was fantastic.
She was.
And she's always fantastic, actually. She's quite a person.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we raised money for the victims of Fukushima. We also had Kitaro. And Kitaro really, in my mind, is the godfather of New Age music. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was listening to his music, you know, even before some other folks
before there was a Wyndham Hill.
I mean, he really invented the genre. He's a lovely guy,
mm-hmm.
a really nice guy, and he had a huge drum. You came later, but he had a drum that must have been 10 feet in diameter that he beat with, and it was very, very powerful.
Yeah,
really amazing. So
also Jason Mraz did a duet with I don't remember the other guy's name, but he played percussion and sang harmony with him, and they were terrific.
Fabulous. So all in all, it was a spectacular day.
Mm-hmm.
John Hall played also, sang a song about energy. Two songs, one, you know, The Warm Power of the Sun, and then a new one he wrote, which is available online.
For people who are saying John Hall, he was a member of Congress for one term.
Two. Actually,
he had two terms from upstate New York.
Yeah,
he was the band leader of, was it Orleans?
Orleans.
Yeah, back in the 70s.
Right, and he wrote "Still the One" and "Dance with Me."
Uh huh. Yeah.
So overall, it was an astonishing day.
Mm-hmm.
It lasted. The concert went from 3 to about 10.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking, God, did these people get a bargain? I mean, of course, I got a bargain. But, you know, I will tell you one thing. People who envy those who are backstage. You know, I had a backstage pass because I was a speaker. You can't really hear the music backstage.
No, you hear the bass line.
You have to go. Many, many times when my favorite acts, well, they were all my favorite acts. Mm-hmm. Every time I wanted to hear the music, when I wasn't online to sing, I went out in the audience.
Mm-hmm.
And so never envy the people backstage. You just can't hear the music.
You're watching a bunch of guys working, and the musicians aren't interested in you because they've got their game face on.
And you see the backs of some really great people, and that's it. You know.
Yeah.
So I ran out front whenever I possibly could. And there was a huge energy fair, which I think you probably saw. Gosh, I guess there must have been 30 booths from people from all over the world, all over the country anyway, who came to get signatures and pass out literature. It was very, very successful.
Yeah.
Lots and lots of people.
So, Harvey, how do we turn the tide here? Certainly the tragedy at Fukushima continues to unfold. We have meltdowns and radiation releases that appear to be equal to or worse than those that occurred immediately after the earthquake and tsunami. The storage pools continue to represent a huge threat. We've got radioactive water that's been used to cool the reactors that is flowing all over the place. And despite that, here in the United States, we've stopped caring. There was really good coverage for the first week after the earthquake and tsunami. And since then, it's, you know, I haven't seen Rachel Maddow cover this. And to her credit, working for a General Electric network, she stuck her neck out and did mention that the reactors were built by General Electric.
Yeah, that's right.
But I haven't heard her talk about it recently. And, you know, I don't want to put her on the spot. It's just
it's
a barometer.
Not her fault.
And the corporate media does bring us, you know, occasional blurbs about what's going on there. But we're in deep denial as the Obama administration is moving forward. And despite all the budget talk and the need to cut unnecessary spending, the $37 billion in loan guarantees for new nuclear power plant construction, that's still in effect, isn't it?
No, actually, here's what's happened.
Yeah?
And first of all, I agree with you. The coverage of Fukushima for the first week or so was very good, especially on CNN.
Mm-hmm.
I watched CNN pretty regularly. Anderson Cooper was very good, and John King. And they really didn't pull many punches, except on the health stuff. Sanjay Gupta really pissed me off because he was standing there with Anderson Cooper and said, well, basically, you know, this radiation isn't going to harm anybody in the United States, which is an utter lie.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the radiation has came here. It has been coming here. It continues to come here. You know, it continues to contaminate our food, our water, and our fish and our oceans, and it's a complete nightmare. And it was completely irresponsible for Gupta and all these other clowns in the major media to say that there's no health effects.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we're definitely getting it here. There was an interesting moment. They were discussing radiation, and they were in Fukushima. And they're talking about radiation, and I could see as they were talking that Anderson Cooper, it kind of dawned on him where he was. And their next report was from Tokyo. You know, he just got the hell out of there.
Yeah.
As well he should. And as you know,
you think he maxed out on his Sievers?
Yeah, absolutely. And as you know, Peter, the coverage, the guys who covered Three Mile Island dropped like flies. I mean, there was an article in the Village Voice by Paul Cowan a few years after TMI surveying the reporters that were there. And it was a horrific death toll. Absolutely terrible. So, mm-hmm. you know, these guys who went to cover Fukushima are not going to do any better.
Yeah.
And I will not be surprised. I hate to say this. I will not be surprised to start reading about these reporters dying of cancer in the coming years. Although cancer is a whole other tale, and you and I should do a story, or rather a show, on alternative cures to cancer, because I've been looking into this and the whole cancer industry, which itself is a cancer.
Mm.
I don't know if you've done any shows on it, but it's
a little bit.
Yeah, it's a pretty mm-hmm. amazing situation. So the coverage of Fukushima abruptly ended the day we invaded Libya.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that was the it completely disappeared. And I say, oh, well, that's, you know, basically why. And CNN, all of them stopped. Rachel Maddow continued to do some. But lately, I mean, the New York Times has sustained a thread of coverage. There are a few people at the Times, I think, who understand how bad this is.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we have, you and I have been covering the nuclear beat for a long, long time. Never in the course of doing this have we encountered serious discussion of three simultaneous meltdowns. You know, it was always a question of, well, what would happen if a nuclear plant melted?
Mm-hmm.
We never talked about three.
Yeah.
And they're ongoing. These meltdowns are still continuing to happen.
Mm-hmm.
There is a spent fuel pool flying in the air about 100 feet up at Unit 4, which is may or may not have coolant. And the Unit 4, the building there, if God forbid if there's an aftershock, many people have looked at this building think it would fall over.
Mm-hmm.
And if it did fall over with a spent fuel, an uncovered spent fuel pool, I mean, we're in hell. I mean, that's really, you know, that's the worst case scenario.
Yeah.
So what people have come to understand, one lesson that Fukushima has taught is that even when a nuclear plant shuts down, its need for cooling water continues. And so at Fukushima, when they lost
the pumps, because number 4 was offline at the time, right?
Yeah, 4, 5, 6.
4 and 5. Yeah, 4, 5, and 6. Okay.
And, but, you know, it does not diminish the fact that they have to continue to have cooling water into the core and into the spent fuel pools.
Mm-hmm.
And when
and clarify something for me. A reactor can be offline, but it is still the process continues, right? I mean, you don't actually stop a nuclear reactor for a cold shutdown just because you're taking it offline. So they were in some kind of a sleep mode. Is that the way to put it? Like a computer does?
Yeah. Well, they were. I guess there were repairs, and maybe they were preparing for refueling. I don't remember what was happening at 4, 5, and 6. Mm-hmm. But nonetheless, you have to go a hell of a long way to take a reactor core to the point where it needs no cooling water. And there is no situation you can get in a spent fuel pool where it does not need continued power. The only thing you can do with spent fuel to get it away from the need for power is to pull it out and put it in a dry cask, which mm-hmm. is just a box, yeah. basically, with vents. Mm-hmm. That's all it is. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we still have a critical situation in Fukushima. God forbid there should be an aftershock of any magnitude there. We could see, you know, the re-eruption of very serious damage. Mm-hmm. And the stories...
Even without that, Harvey, it's not clear in the American media what the current plans are. Are they going to sarcophagize the reactors there at Fukushima Daiichi?
I don't think they know. Yeah. That's one of the things I've been saying about this accident is that we know that they're lying. You know, it's an assumed that the utility company lies. It's assumed that the government will lie. What's really terrifying is they don't really know what the hell is going on. So even when they say what they think is the truth, there's no reason to believe it's the truth, mm-hmm. even from an objective standpoint. So this is so far beyond the engineering and scientific capabilities of the nuclear industry. 3 simultaneous meltdowns, 3 more reactors in serious trouble. You know, there were 7 reactors within the last 5 years at the Kashiwazaki plant. They were hit by an earthquake. They were forced offline. You have Hamaoka there, which is in a serious earthquake zone, and the prime minister ordered them to shut. And you actually have almost 3/4 of the reactors in Japan are shut right now for various technical reasons. And
they're rationing power, aren't they?
Yes. And mm-hmm. the prefectures in Japan do have the ability to prevent the reopening of these plants, unlike here where the power is totally centralized mm-hmm. in the federal government. There, the prefectural governments have some say, and they could conceivably prevent all these reactors from reopening. Mm-hmm. It could conceivably happen legally that within a year, Japan will have 0 nuclear power plants operating, mm-hmm. which would be a great thing.
Yeah.
But I have to say that country will never recover from this. This is just, we just had a report, which I posted at nukefree.org, where a very, very credible Japanese scientist has estimated that more than 25 times more radiation was released by Fukushima than by Hiroshima, by the bombing of Hiroshima. Now, this makes a lot of sense because the bomb that was dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, both of them, were detonated in the air. They did not hit the ground. And so what you got from these, you got some particulate emissions, where the vortex would sweep up and irradiate stuff, dirt from the ground, right, and destroy buildings and things like that. But the vast majority, the vast bulk of the radiation at Hiroshima was gamma ray and X-ray, because these were from the explosion up in the air. Had the bombs hit the ground at Hiroshima and Nagasaki, they would have irradiated all the particles, the particulate matter, the dirt, the building material, so on, the human bodies. And then that would have become particulate matter, and then they would have been a beta and alpha emitters, beta being electrons, or, mm-hmm. and then alpha particles are 2 protons and 2 neutrons. And then that could have been inhaled. So, but that stuff was, so that was not a major piece of the fallout at Hiroshima or Nagasaki, but at Fukushima, all this stuff was in the core, at the cores, the 6 cores. And, you know, the amount of radiation emitted at Fukushima is so far in excess of the bombings because this material goes up into the atmosphere and then it's ingested into the human body. And so when an alpha or a beta emitter goes into the human body, it lodges in the tissue. And it's a very, very different calculation than if you're X-rayed or hit with gamma rays.
So, Harvey, what should we be watching for in terms of radiation impacts, particularly here along the West Coast? I've seen isolated reports of serious illness and some death among children in the Pacific Northwest, but I can't directly tie it to radiation exposure. What do you see as the primary risks, and how can we mark them? How can we observe them?
Well, it's a nightmare because you can't really label, deaths that come directly from radiation, especially from so far away. And the nuclear industry has been very, very good at not measuring fallout and at not tracking human health in relation to fallout. And so to make a case that someone has been harmed by radiation from Fukushima is pretty difficult to do. Now, after Chernobyl, 10 days after Chernobyl, it rained. And there were radioactive measurements that indicated quite clearly that the cloud from Chernobyl had come to California. And there was happened to be a study at Point Reyes National Seashore of the bird births there. And the ranger, the park ranger, had records going back 10 years. And the bird births dropped in the month of May in 1986 by 60%. That was a pretty clear indication. But beyond that, you know, this country doesn't really do epidemiology.
And now, what about the radiation detectors? We were told shortly after Fukushima that there is an array spaced along the California coast and that something like 4 out of 7 of them were inoperative.
They're always inoperative. I mean, you know, they do a really good job of making it inoperative. And what we should have in this country is a national system of radiation monitoring where we know we should have a real-time map on the internet of radiation and where it's coming down and what kind it is and what you can do about it. But the federal government's done a great job of not doing that. It would cost, you know, a minuscule amount of money to do that compared to what's spent on utter nonsense like the military budget. And so, Obama, and I can't even begin to tell you how abominable his behavior has been in the face of Fukushima. He's been horrible, unconscionable, indefensible. What he did was he got up there, I don't know, 4 or 5 days after the accident, and he said, oh, it was a terrible accident. Our hearts go out to the people of Japan, of course, but don't worry, nothing's going to happen here, and by the way, we're going to continue to pursue nuclear power. Now, this is, by the time he spoke, radiation had already arrived here. But the EPA, the NRC, none of the agencies were monitoring it or reporting on it, and it was very definitely significant. I have to say, the only time I ever broke down on a radio show, all these 40 years I've been doing radio, I broke down because I have a daughter in L.A., and I started thinking about the radiation coming down there. And she's 24. So,
and she's about to give
birth to my grandchild. So, yeah. You know, I didn't know that at the time, but nonetheless. And so for the federal government to fail to monitor this and to provide guidance on what people can do, you know, I mean, there are things you can do, not much, but there are things you can do. You can wash your vegetables and you can take potassium iodide, although that has to be done with some discretion. You can't just start popping potassium iodide, and it may not be relevant anyway because it only works for iodine, for iodine-131. It doesn't have anything to do with strontium or cesium or potassium or plutonium, any of the other stuff that comes down. So, you know, for the federal government to fail to do anything about this, and then to continue to pursue, for Obama to continue to pursue radioactive loan guarantees to build new nuclear plants, he wants $36 billion. Now, given the budget crisis, I don't know what's going to happen. It's not in the current. It wasn't in the deal. The $36 billion in loan guarantees was not in the deal.
It was not cut out in the deal, you mean?
No, it's not in there. It's not in the, it's currently not in what they agreed to do.
Oh, okay.
So, but it could be added, and they've hired Pete Domenici to lobby to get it stuck into a continuing resolution or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And Obama will support it.
Yeah.
And, you know, but if we stop them, I think they're dead.
So I want you to hold a thought here because I want to come back to what your strategy is for Americans to push back and shut down nuclear power plants and prevent new ones from being built. But there is an interesting model, and that's Germany.
Right.
Germany is a country that has invested heavily in nuclear power, something like 25 reactors?
17.
17, mm-hmm. Okay. And Angela Merkel, who did not have a real green background,
no.
In order to negotiate recent regional elections, where there was a strong pushback at the mm-hmm. regional level, the state level, mm-hmm. She relented. And as I understand it, Germany is now on track to shut down all of their nuclear reactors over the next 10 years. Is that right?
Correct.
Mm-hmm.
I followed this pretty closely. The Germans have there's a very strong Green Party in Germany. And they did win agreement to get these reactors phased out several years ago. And then Angela Merkel came in, the center-right coalition, and they kind of rolled that back. And she started talking about, prolonging the life of these reactors and even building new ones. And it really infuriated the Greens, infuriated the left. And so the left called a major national anti-nuclear demonstration. And then in between the time they called it and the time it was to happen, Fukushima happened. Mm. And they had a huge turnout, like 160,000 people. I mean, a lot of people. And they were all over the country. And then the word went out, actually, that she's trained as a physicist or a chemist. She has an advanced scientific degree, Angela Merkel.
Mm-hmm.
And the word went out that she had looked at Fukushima. And where she had been supportive of the technology before, she said, as a scientist, yeah, I don't think so. We're not going to do this.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that could have been a planted story, but, you never know. And simultaneously, the Greens won an election, and I believe it was in Bavaria, a very conservative state. It would be like the Greens winning in Texas,
mm-hmm.
And that combined sent a very powerful message. And I think what really happened was that the big corporations that run Germany took another look and they said, we can do this. We can go green and make more money. And what's happened now, and this is why this time is so critical, is when we first started fighting the nukes back in the 70s, we were saying, well, if we stop nuclear power, we could take the money and develop solar and it would be cheaper. Well, it's 30 years later and by God, solar is cheaper. And, for the first year now, I follow the literature pretty close, Bloomberg's and the Wall Street Journal and all these trade magazines are saying, hey, solar's cheaper. If you're a capitalist pig and you don't care about people or the planet, but you want to make money, you're going to invest in solar now, not in nuclear. That's where the money is. And so the technology has made the turning point. In fact, General Electric, I posted this at nucree.org, General Eckert says now that photovoltaic cells will be cheaper than coal in 5 years.
Hmm.
So, this is big.
You mean clean coal?
Yeah. the three great oxymorons in American society, safe nuclear, clean coal, and Rush Limbaugh. So
now, Harvey, I was in France for a couple of weeks in July.
Uh-huh.
And in the city of Avignon, they have a summer festival. There are all kinds of musicians and other performers in the plazas. And there was a very well-received group of anti-nuclear activists. Now, France is different from Germany in many respects.
Mm-hmm.
The nuclear facilities are completely government-controlled. The nuclear power industry is linked to the creation of nuclear weapons.
Mm-hmm.
They have the most advanced, to my knowledge, correct me if I don't have the right info here, but they are the most advanced in reprocessing spent fuel.
Well, if you can call it advanced. I mean, they're going nowhere with it. But
well, but as compared to us, we don't even attempt it, right?
Right.
And so rather than leaving spent fuel rods at a reactor site, the French do reprocess it.
Mm-hmm.
And at least they are reducing the risk from the spent fuel rods lying around for decades and posing the kind of risk that we're seeing.
Well, yes and no, because when they reprocess it, it's an incredibly filthy process.
Is it?
And they dump really, really serious radiation into the English Channel.
Hmm.
To the extent that 11 other countries in Europe have complained and asked the French to shut La Hague, which is their reprocessing facility.
Mm-hmm.
And so, safe is a relative term. It may not be as easy to use for nuclear weapons,
mm-hmm.
but it's absolutely devastating mm-hmm. to the environment.
Well, I didn't use the word safe.
Right.
I said advanced.
Advanced, yeah, right.
Well, and that's a term that can be, interpreted in many ways. So if France, I believe, gets 80% of its electricity from nukes now. Is that right?
Yes, but, and I love, you pointed out that the industry is completely controlled by the government. I love all these right-wing free market types who, go on and on about the nuclear industry in France, failing to point out that it's national socialism.
Mm-hmm.
And I use that term advisedly. It's not democratic socialism. It's national socialism. This is controlled by the state. It is operated, monitored, and reported on by the state. And, there's a sliver of private money they put in there for a show. But it's a completely fascist operation, the French nuclear industry.
Mm-hmm.
Now, interestingly enough, you know how many reactors are under construction in France?
I don't.
One.
Yeah.
They're not building new reactors. They're having a hell of a time with the one they're building. It's in Flamanville. They just announced it's years and years behind budget, behind schedule, and mm-hmm. billions over budget. It's a fiasco.
Mm-hmm.
And the French public opinion has turned against nuclear power. They want wind.
Yeah.
So, it's a whole other... And there was a time when French anti-nuclear people would be run out of town on a... croissant, mm-hmm. It would be thrown away. So,
well, the area where I spent time is Northern Provence. It's called Haute-Provence,
mm-hmm.
and it includes an icon that many people know from the Tour de France, France bike race, which is Mont Ventoux. Ventoux is the word for wind in France.
Oh, uh-huh.
And the Mistral, which is the prevailing wind, which can be quite stiff,
mm-hmm.
It blows through that region. And they have clocked winds up to 140 miles an hour.
Wow.
At Mont Ventoux. I was there 2 weeks ago. I didn't see a windmill anywhere. Not one. And it's a perfect spot for
yeah.
it.
Although, windmills, 140 miles an hour is too fast.
Well, those aren't common.
Right,
okay,
right.
It's just peak. I'm using that to describe the potential there.
No, but they are moving to wind. I think they've had it with nukes mm-hmm. in France.
So, now let's come back to these United States.
Yeah.
How do we overcome the powerful lobby that supports nuclear energy, and it's bipartisan, but Senator Kyle from Arizona is really their boy, mm-hmm. the leader in the Senate for these loan guarantees and the cheerleader for continuing to invest in nuclear power. We've seen Democrats either go silent or, in Obama's case, go for nuclear power.
But is he really a Democrat? Well, we won't go into that.
So, politically, you're a smart guy, and you're a historian and an activist. So, paint me a picture. How do we get from here to there?
Well, it's tough, but we have won for the last 5 years, amazingly enough, against all odds. But in 2007, the industry came into Congress, and they wanted $50 billion bucks for loan guarantees. And Barney Jackson and Graham and I got together, and we had Tom Campbell and David Fenton and formed this thing called NukeFree.org. And they did a music video and a website. And we passed a petition, and then we had a press event in Congress. And there was a whole national grassroots movement. This was the most visible part. And we won. I mean, we got the $50 billion reduced to 18.5. And since 2007, they haven't been able to get anything. And it's been miraculous. Every year we say,
okay, but how do we get to from 18.5 to 36, which is...
Well, Obama's asked for 36, but given the current financial crisis, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they can be pro-nuclear as they want, but for them to come in there in the face of what's being done to the federal budget in terms of the cutting and slashing and raping and pillaging and turn around and ask for $36 billion, that's going to be tough. And our people on the Hill are pretty optimistic about stopping them this year. So mm-hmm. we've never been at this point in the year, we have never been optimistic. We always wondered how the hell we were going to win.
Mm-hmm.
And, there's that great line in Shakespeare in Love where somebody says, Jeffrey Rush character says, somehow it all works out. And then somebody asks him how, and he says, well, I don't know. It's a mystery. And that would be the only way to describe what's happened in the last few years. But this year, people are actually, I hope it's not a reverse bad sign, but people are pretty optimistic that they're not going to be able to get this money. Mm-hmm. If they don't get the federal money to build new nuclear plants, they're dead. There's no private money Hasn't been for years.
Well, this is one of the arguments I use. And as you know, I work part-time at a radio station here in San Francisco, KGO.
Yeah.
And one of the hosts who's been there for 30 years is a physicist from the University of California named Bill Wattenberg.
Right.
And he holds forth as the man who knows all, knows everything.
Right.
And I have respect for Bill, but on nuclear power, he's got a huge blind spot.
Mm-hmm.
And he gets pedantic and starts talking down to people and saying that, you know, it's no riskier than the background radiation that's produced by the Earth. And he offers a lot of commentary like that. Well, I can't beat him on science. I hit the wall early in science, okay?
Yeah, but you...
But
you know
my fundamental argument, Harvey, is that if Wall Street won't fund the capital requirements for the nuclear power industry, that is the only signal I need. Because if the greedsters won't take a risk and put our lives on the line so that they can make a profit, then that's really all I need to hear.
Yeah, well, Wall Street has been willing to invest in nuclear for a long time.
Yeah, 30 years.
It's a long time. And the only way and the way we have won, by the way, the anti-nuclear movement has a legitimate claim to have stopped this industry. The one surefire clear sign that we've stopped the industry is that they haven't been able to move with private money. And we have cut them off from getting federal money. There's no doubt about that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they've got dribs and drabs here, but unlike France, where, and I hate to say this, but the socialists came in and pushed nuclear power. Here in the United States, we have prevented them from doing that. And so that's why since 1974, no reactor ordered since 1974 has been completed. Now, you've got a couple that they've restarted to start to build, and two in South Carolina, two in Georgia.
Right.
I have my doubts that they're going to finish those reactors. Mm-hmm. If we cut that, there's still $10 billion left in the loan fund, and they can't even find a reactor, a project to give it to. Mm-hmm. Every time they turn around, and you know, the bottom falls out of these projects.
Mm-hmm. Now, Harvey, one of the most sinister bits of propaganda in recent years has come from people who generally deny climate change as a human-caused condition, yet they're willing to argue that nuclear power is better than coal in relation to global warming.
Right. I love that.
And
doesn't exist, but in order to fight climate change, we need nuclear power.
Yeah. And, you know, it's anybody who's objective and rational who evaluates these arguments will find them coming up short. But there was an op-ed in advance of the Muse concert in the San Francisco mm-hmm. Chronicle, which was making a similar case, saying, oh, you know, nuclear power is benign when it comes to carbon, and therefore we should overlook the waste issue, the cost overruns, the meltdown threat, and the risk of earthquakes hitting, say, the Hosgree Fault off of San Luis Obispo.
Right.
So how do we cut through that crap?
Well, this came from the Breakthrough Foundation, which you rightly point out is a global warming denier.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I love they say, you know, we don't believe in global warming, but here we're going to hire these two people, whoever they were, and we're going to pay them, and they're going to write an op-ed saying that we got to have nuclear power to fight global warming. I mean, you know, come on, guys. And it's utter nonsense. Nuclear power exacerbates global warming. It accelerates global warming because, first of all, the fuel cycle, the mining of uranium releases tremendous quantities of radon gas in addition to carbon. The milling, the enrichment is a huge energy sink. It takes tremendous quantities of energy to enrich uranium fuel. And then, you know, they burn it. When they burn uranium, essentially they're taking inert uranium and turning it into this huge quantities of heat. So unlike carbon, here they eliminate the middleman. They just go ahead and heat the earth directly. And then all these, you know, we're having situations now where they have to shut nuclear plants in the middle of the summer because it's too hot, and they're pouring hot water into streams and lakes and rivers that are heating up to 90 degrees Fahrenheit. This has been happening in France for years, and now it's happened in Alabama, and will continue to happen. And so right smack in the middle of the summer, when you theoretically most need cooling power to cool, they're heating up the planet.
Right. And the narrow argument is true that nuclear power plants do not emit carbon.
Well, when
but
they operate.
The heat exchange is very clear, even to a casual observer. Every nuclear power plant is sited near a water source for the massive cooling requirements that, that they present. And so to claim that, you know, this exchange of heat from a reactor to water is not going to warm the planet, you know, is false. And the narrow truth that it's not emitting carbon does not undermine the principle.
And it does emit carbon. I mean, it emits carbon through the fuel cycle.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, at the tail end, when you also building the plants themselves emits a huge quantity of carbon, and then you have to manage the spent fuel, and that can be done. That's going to be done by fossil fuels, and you got to move it to wherever they're going to move it if they ever find a place. So no, it's a nightmare, and like I said, it really nuclear power is a global warming agent. Avoids the middleman. It just bangs the stuff right in the atmosphere on its own. So you know, but the most important thing about global warming and nuclear power is nuclear power diverts the funds that should be going to renewables that will, in fact, solve global warming. And we are in the revolution about that. You know, solar, wind, tidal, geothermal, ocean thermal, sustainable biofuels, and increased efficiency and conservation, that's the stuff that's really going to save us from global warming. And every dollar that goes into nuclear power is a dollar that doesn't go into the true green sources that really will make the difference.
And Harvey Wasserman, you detailed that in your visionary treatise called Solartopia.
Solartopia, our green
and I'm sure the book is still available, right?
It's at my website.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And
so that's harveywasserman.org
and Solartopia.
Solartopia.org.
It's actually harveywasserman.com.
Okay.
And Solartopia.org.
All right.
Thank you for mentioning.
And then nukefree.org.
That's where Bonnie Jackson and Graham reside, and where we post articles on a regular basis about nuclear power. And
then does Muse have a website?
Musicians United for Safe Energy with four, the number.
Number four. So okay. And let's not leave out Free Press.
Oh, yeah. Well, I write for regularly for freepress.org in Columbus, Ohio, and we publish all the great articles about
Election fraud.
Election theft, and which is going on.
Partner, Bob Fitrakis, was on with me just two podcasts ago.
Oh, good. Mm-hmm. Good. And, you know, new stuff is always breaking. And we are in the midst of elections and recall elections in Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm.
Be very interesting to see how they try and steal that.
Right. And you've got a referendum to repeal SB 5.
Well, it was
Ohio.
Kicked off the ballot. We had referenda to legalize medical marijuana and to repeal SB 5, and they're both been thrown into limbo by the Republican Attorney General. So.
Oh, really? I missed that. Yeah. Mike DeWine is now your Attorney General, right? The former senator.
Yeah, and I don't know what's cooking with that. It's going to be a little dicey, I think.
Very interesting. Well, we'll keep an eye on that, and we'll be in touch. Harvey, thank you for joining us, and thanks for everything you do.
Well, Peter, you are the greatest. It's really an honor to be on your show. I'm so glad you're still broadcasting/podcasting.
Got more listeners. They're spread all over the country and all around the world than I had with a syndicated show on AM radio, and it's delightful.
Yeah, well, you know, I actually have a show now, too, we can
you do?
Mention. Yeah, it's called the Solartopia Green Power Hour, and it's with something called TalkTainmentRadio.com.
And you follow Fitrakis's Fight Back show on Wednesdays,
and we
right?
have more promos than God, but nonetheless, there is some content that seeps in, and I'm glad to have people check out the web on that, too.
Yeah.
But, Peter, it's an honor. I'm really glad you're still on the air.
All right. Good to see you, Harvey. Thank you.
Good to see you. Thank you so much.
Hey, thank you for listening, and I hope you will fight for justice for the Palestinians and no nukes for Americans. Happy trails.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.